we're exploring our planet's underwater frontier with a renowned cave diver here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer. Kent, thanks for being here. This hour's expeditions will take us into the claustrophobic blackness of water-filled caves. We'll get a better handle on the risk and reward of underwater exploration. What do you want to know about cave diving and underwater photography and filmmaking? Join in through the hour, 800-642-1234. Jill Heinerth has completed more than 7,500 dives around the world, ventured deeper into underwater caves than any woman before her. Her new memoir is out. It's called Into the Planet, My Life as a Cave Diver. Jill, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Oh, thanks for having me.
The first three words of your book really set a tenor for what is to come. The words are, if I die. And you take us to the dive in Antarctica at the very front of this. And I'm wondering how, because the dive was so treacherous, how you could remember such poignant details when you are in such a traumatic situation there. Take us to Antarctica.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, it's if I die, it will be in the most glorious place that nobody has ever seen. That's the opening line in the book. And I was inside the largest iceberg in recorded history, leading a diving team to be the first people to cave dive inside an iceberg. And it's stunningly beautiful, but incredibly dangerous with shifting ice. It's melting, it's breaking apart. But it is beautiful and harboring this remarkable ecosystem that we had never documented before. And I journal these things as I'm on expedition so that I don't forget the details.
And so you are down there and it's frigid water, so cold. Mm. How cold is it?
Well, it's minus 1.8 Celsius or 28 Fahrenheit, so 1/10 of a degree colder, and the ocean would be solid. So it's as cold as you can dive in.
And so how do you get down to this iceberg? Where are you going in it? Mm-hmm. What is this labyrinth?
So the iceberg had calved away from the Ross ice shelf. This is almost 20 years ago in Antarctica. And when it happened, we decided to go intercept this iceberg and explore it and do some scientific investigation and be the first people to cave dive inside the ice. But it's a 12-day voyage from New Zealand to get there. So you have to cross the Southern Ocean, which is, you know, the furious 40s, the screaming 60s. It's just absolutely crazy where storms can ring the earth without, you know, tripping up over land as they do that. So huge seas up to 60 feet tall just to get to the pack ice.
Mm. And so just the journey there is enough to want to turn around, I'm sure. And once you arrive, you have your gear, you get your gear on. Do you go right to work or is there still more prep to figure out, you know, what's going to happen next?
Well, I mean, there's never a handbook for someone that does something for the first time. And so you're progressively, building your concepts of how you will embark on such an endeavor. So, I mean, even getting there, we didn't know how we would push the boat through the pack ice, for instance. I mean, it wasn't a ice strengthened hull. So every day, new experiences sort of inform you how to move forward. And so we kind of, gingerly jump in the water on some of our first dives before we reach the place where we're able to enter the iceberg. And quite frankly, we didn't know for sure that we would find caves in the icebergs. It was just a hypothesis. Mm. So that's exploration.
We're talking with Jill Heinerth. She is a cave diver, underwater explorer, a filmmaker. Her new book, her memoir, it's called Into the Planet. What do you want to know about underwater caving and underwater archaeology? Have you ever been scuba diving in Wisconsin or on vacation? What was that experience like? Join in with your questions, your experiences, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Jill, fortunately on these expeditions, you're not alone. You dive with a team. But that can also have its complications as well, because, you know, some people can certainly, there's more casualty involved. There's more, you know, and there is also decision making that has to take place when you're on a dive. How does that work? Who makes the calls?
Well, I mean, we always enter as a team, and we, you know, always know that we need to be able to be self-sufficient to take care of ourselves, but also willing to help each other. You know, underwater communication can be challenging. We don't generally use full face masks that would allow us to communicate by talking to each other. It's an unnecessary complication in the equipment. So we're using hand signals and light signals, and also a general intuition, because we have, you know, refined ourselves as a team. But it can be challenging to know exactly what someone else is thinking and experiencing at any given time.
And when you get into trouble, it's often, you know, you want to go and save the partner, but there's also people who want to save the gear as well.
Oh, yeah. Well, on this particular project, it was really in the pioneering days of high definition broadcasting equipment. So we actually had like serial number 6 of the newest, latest and greatest HD camera from Sony. And by the time that camera went into an underwater housing, you know, this is like hundreds of thousands of dollars being carried. And my colleague was shooting on this particular dive, and he was really concerned about getting the camera back when we experienced some incredible currents that were trapping us inside the iceberg. It would be like trying to walk against a hurricane force wind, but we're trying to swim against a current that's really strong. And I wasn't sure if we were going to get out of this iceberg. I was afraid we were going to lose our lives, that we were going to be trapped here. And my partner was actually yelling, and I could actually hear him say, "Help me with the camera." And all I'm thinking is, "F the camera." We might die here, you know? But he was convinced that he wanted to get that gear out of the cave.
So how did you get out of that cave? How did you figure your way out?
Well, we turned a 1-hour planned dive into a 3-hour fight for our lives, just pulling and pulling along the seafloor with every bit of energy we had. And when we got, you know, to the point where we could see daylight, you know, out of the cave and could potentially start moving up, there were currents that were just barreling downward down the face of the ice from the melting of the iceberg. I actually used small holes in the ice that were basically burrowed by these small fish to jam my fingers into those holes and use them like handholds to climb the wall of ice.
Oh, wow. And that iceberg, what happened to it?
Well, you know, mere hours after that dive, we were actually planning to do one more dive into the ice to get some more footage for the film and the National Geographic article that we were writing. And the entire iceberg exploded before us, just cracked, broke apart, and turned into a sea of slush as far as the eye could see.
We're with world-renowned cave diver Jill Heinerth. Her new memoir is called Into the Planet. Have you ever been on diving expeditions? What was that experience like? What do you want to know about Jill's work? Join in at 800-642-1234. We'll get back with Jill Heinerth in just a moment. Stay with us on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking with a cave diving explorer here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Earth is covered by vast expanses of water, but less than 5% of the world's oceans have been explored. The deep blue sea is where Jill Heinerth shines. Her diving adventures give us lessons about how to survive, how to thrive in life. Do small spaces frighten you? How would you feel inside a cave underwater? How do you overcome your own fears to take on dangerous work assignments? Join in at 800-642-1234. Tweet us, WPR Mornings. Cave diver Jill Heiner's memoir is called Into the Planet, and she stays with us. Jill, before you were a cave diver, before this occupation, you were a graphic designer. When did you decide that you were making a dramatic shift in your life?
Yeah, well, that was a big change. I had a great career as a graphic designer. I loved what I was doing. The creative process was great. And I was teaching scuba nights and weekends, and that was my hobby. And I was sitting inside those four walls in my office thinking, I have this backwards. I really want to lead a creative life, but underwater. So I sold everything, in my late 20s and decided to start over again and find a way to move forward as a creative professional photographer, cinematographer, and working underwater.
And working mostly with men, kind of forging this as a woman. How was that?
Well, it's like any aspect of society. There are, some gender imbalances in things that are traditionally niches for men. So, I did experience some overt, sexism, but also some, maybe unintended sexism. And I just continued to work hard. But sometimes you do have to jump up and down and wave your arms and ask for the gig when people wouldn't traditionally see you as fitting a particular role.
One of the earlier lessons you learned as a cave diver was about safety, and you point out that more people have died exploring underwater caves than climbing Mount Everest. Why is cave diving so dangerous?
Well, you're diving in a water-filled space under an overhead environment, and so if something goes wrong, you can't just go to the surface. You have to solve all your problems in place. And people can get lost in caves. The silt comes raining down from the ceiling until you have no visibility, and you might need to follow a thin guideline of string by holding onto it to get all the way to the exit. And then you can have equipment problems as well. So training, equipment, redundancy, all of that is incredibly important to a cave diver. And an attention to those safety protocols, like an unwavering attention to the rules, is absolutely critical, or you can lose your life in these environments.
Matt from Evansville called in to ask how you manage anxiety and stress underwater. How do you not panic while, diving and managing your breath and your air? How does that work?
Well, Matt, that's a great question, because it's not just in cave diving. We all experience terrifying things in life. I am scared, every time I go diving. And I think that's important because it means I care about the risks and the outcomes of my activities. And I want to dive with people that are also scared, because it shows me that they also care about risk. But when the worst possible thing happens underwater and my heart wants to just jump out of my chest, I take a really, really deep breath and I literally tell myself, emotions, you won't serve me very well right now. I might not know how to solve a big problem, but I know what the next best positive step is towards a solution, and I do that.
Oh, so you really break it up. You take a mini step in the right direction, and that tells your mind, I'm not solving it immediately, but I'm going and I'm working on it,
And yeah, that gives you a chance to have a lot of small victories that are working in the right direction, because some things are just too big to tackle in life,
What kind of equipment do you use to breathe underwater? If we're not familiar with all of this equipment, can you take us on a tour of what's on you?
Yeah. So a lot of people are familiar with traditional scuba gear, where you wear a tank on your back and you take a breath, and then when you exhale, you make bubbles. Oftentimes, I'm using something much more sophisticated that's very similar to the equipment an astronaut would wear for a spacewalk. It's called a rebreather, and it captures my exhaled breath in a loop and scrubs it clean of carbon dioxide and injects small bits of oxygen to make up for whatever I've metabolized so that I can continue to reuse that gas over and over again. So at times I've had as much as 500 or 600 pounds of equipment that I'm swimming through the cave system, the rebreather, extra bailout tanks, a scientific package. Sometimes I'm using an underwater scooter that pulls me through the water, and carrying it back up in case that one breaks down. So there can be a lot of equipment for these big dives.
You're like a pack mule underwater.
Yeah. I prefer to think of it more like, you know, the similar stuff to what an astronaut wears.
How do you adjust to different pressures? What about the water pressure?
Yeah. So people who have considered scuba diving have probably, you know, swam in a swimming pool and descended to the bottom of the swimming pool and gone, oh my gosh, my ears hurt, my sinuses hurt. How do people do this? And that's because the pressure of the water, the weight of the water is pressing on those flexible air-filled spaces in your body, like in your sinuses and in your middle ear. Scuba divers learn to equalize those spaces just like the way you do when you ride in the mountains and you feel like your ears pop, or even in an elevator, you feel your ears pop, quote, you know. Mm-hmm. We actually pinch our nose and blow very gently to equalize those spaces. But the, you know, the fluid parts of your body, you know, your muscles and your tissues and everything, don't feel the pressure as you descend down under the water. So it's not like you feel this crushing weight of the universe on you. Yeah.
We're talking with Jill Heinerth. She is a cave diver, an underwater explorer, filmmaker. Her memoir is called Into the Planet, My Life as a Cave Diver. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Are you concerned about water safety? Why do you think that is important? Have you or someone you know nearly drowned? What happened? You can call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Jill, why is it important to adjust your body to different water pressures gradually?
Well, we can descend down pretty quickly as long as we can equalize our ears. But the longer we stay down and the deeper we go, the more inert gas gets stuffed into our tissues, basically. So as we're breathing, we're not using the nitrogen in the breathing mix, or for deeper dives, helium that we use in the breathing mix. It just gets stashed into our tissues, much in the same way that there is gas dissolved into a bottle of soda pop. As you return to the surface, you have to come up at a very slow staged pace to relieve that pressure. And it would be, again, similar to that soda pop bottle. If you rip the cap off a pop bottle, it might fizz. If you shake it up, it's even worse. So the diver has to reacclimate their body, slowly releasing the pressure, so the gas that's stored in their tissues doesn't suddenly come out and cause injuries, everything from a rash to pain, tingling, or even death.
And you've experienced decompression sickness before. What was that like?
Yeah, it was pretty scary. I had a fairly serious hit of decompression sickness that we also called the bends. And the first thing I felt was this niggling, like as if there were ants crawling around on my thighs. And then it was almost as if like there were bugs biting my legs. It was pretty scary. Fortunately, I overcame. I mean, my doctor said never dive again after that accident, but I slowly worked my way, you know, back to diving again.
And divers, they take the bends very seriously. And when a diver, you know, has a threat like that, a scare like that, what is the reaction from the team?
Well, I mean, it's an emergency. Usually a person is treated with oxygen. They breathe oxygen on site, and they're evacuated to what's called a recompression chamber, where they can repressurize your body back to where it was, and then very slowly over time release that pressure, watching for the symptoms to see whether they return or not. And sometimes you have to have a series of those runs in the chamber, as we call them, recompression chamber, as a result.
How often does that happen? Is that a rare thing where you have decompression sickness?
Well, I mean, it's a spectrum decompression illness. And so some people can have very mild experiences from, you know, extreme fatigue or a skin rash or something like that, to these
very serious situations like paralysis or breathing difficulties. So I think there's probably a lot more decompression illness than people are willing to admit. I mean, it is a sports injury. It's a risk of going into an environment under pressure. We do, you know, keep statistics. There are organizations that manage that. So it's not uncommon, but we take it very seriously when it happens.
We're with Jill Heinerth as our guide. She's taking us on caving expeditions. Her new memoir is called Into the Planet. What questions do you have about cave diving or photography? What do you want to know about the depths of our ocean and what you see there? Join in with your curiosities throughout the hour, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this conversation right after this news update. Stay with us here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're exploring the remarkable life of a cave diver. This hour of the morning show, I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Jill Heinerth's book is called Into the Planet, and she's completed more than 7,500 dives, descended farther into the inner depths of our watery planet than any other woman. And you have a line to her at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about how she plans for dives, how she handles stressful conditions, and how you find your inner adventurous spirit? Call in. You can also email ideas at WPR.org. Let's go back to the phones now. Steve is joining us from Sheboygan this morning. Hi, Steve.
Hello. I'd like to just say I'm really enjoying this program. I can relate to a lot of things that the author is saying. If it's possible, I'd like to tell you a little story about what happened to me back in the late 70s.
I understand you're a scuba diver?
Yes, I was part of a group of early shipwreck explorers in the Great Lakes. And on one of my, back in the late 70s, I decided in about the middle of March, we had a fantastic day out here off of Sheboygan. And we have a shipwreck in 165 feet of water. I decided to go out there by myself about 8 miles offshore and shoot 16 millimeter film of the inside of the shipwreck. So anyway, I went down, moored my boat to the ship, took my 16 millimeter Bolex cameras with the 4 Ikelite movie lights on it, and swam down 165 feet, went down into the hold of the ship, and was heading towards the bow of the ship inside when all of a sudden I had a free flow in my regulator. I was wearing twin 72s, and I could not get the free flow to stop. So I understand the moment when things like this happened, you have to get out of this situation fast. And I just remember I was talking to myself. I made a free ascent from 165 feet, and I was talking to myself all the way up.
Wow.
It was kind of an interesting situation.
Did
and
you
I just wanted to relate this?
Yeah. Did you dive again, Steve? Did you go back down?
Oh, yes. I'm 73 years old now. And I just finished diving about 2 years ago. I was in my TriMix class, and I decided this was just getting too hard to do.
Oh, Steve, so, what a story and what a history. Jill Heinerth, what about exploring shipwrecks on the Great Lakes?
Oh, boy. Well, I grew up in the Great Lakes, and so some of my very first dives were on shipwrecks. It's remarkable. There's over 6,000 shipwrecks in the Great Lakes, and many, many hundreds within the range of recreational divers. We're so fortunate to have these beautifully preserved wooden wrecks that are, you know, 100 to 200 years old in the lakes. They're absolutely amazing places to dive.
Yeah, what's the difference between exploring, going down and exploring a shipwreck versus trying to navigate caves or more of these landscape-type features underwater?
Yeah, well, the caves branch off into the planet like, you know, the branches of a tree, and you're always under the obligation of being in an overhead environment and needing to solve all your problems there. So you can't directly ascend to the surface. Now, with shipwreck diving, sometimes you can go inside and have to deal with a ceiling over your head. But for the most part, you know, we actually swim around the outside of shipwrecks and get that beautiful view. And so a lot of wreck diving is recreational, where you can swim straight to the surface. Now, if you're doing deeper stuff like Steve was talking about, then sometimes there's that decompression obligation that requires that slow ascent back to the surface. And that's a bit of a ceiling in itself.
How do you deal with tight spaces? What do you tell yourself in claustrophobic environments?
Well, I'm not a bit claustrophobic, so so I actually love, you know, dark, you know, cozy environments. I'm very, very careful and thoughtful because I realize that whatever I go into, if I can't turn around, I may need to be able to back out. So I have to keep that in the front of my mind all the time. If you're in a shipwreck, of course, there's a lot of things that could entangle you or snag your equipment. That can happen in caves too, but always a consideration.
And some of those cords are that's your lifeline to getting out.
Yeah, your equipment has lots of danglies, as we call them, and that's something that's very important for a diver to get control of, is to make sure that their equipment is extremely streamlined, and that you know where everything is, and that you can reach it at any given time. So, you know, if you have a free flow like Steve was describing, you may need to be able to reach back and turn off a valve. Or if you get something entangled, snagged, you may need to, you know, be able to figure out intuitively, oh, that must be my canister dive light. I know what that is, and then reach back and unhook it, take it off so that you can squeeze through and recover from being entangled.
On these dives, you see so many creatures up close. I wonder what they think of you when you're down there. I'm like, what's this foreign thing?
You know, kids always ask me, do you dive with sharks? And I'm like, yeah, of course I dive with sharks. I'm so excited when I get to see a shark, because usually the shark is swimming away from me because, you know, I'm not looking at it and going, oh my God, a shark. It's actually looking at me and going, oh my God, a human. So there are a lot more sharks that die at the hands of humans than the other way around. I mean, we are foreigners in their environment. We don't look like, smell like, taste like, you know, anything in their food chain. They're not interested.
I love it when the seals kind of poke around and are playful to you, and then they decide that they've had enough of you.
Yep. Yeah, they're done. I love, you know, sea lions out off of the west coast of British Columbia. I go dive with them quite a bit. We jump off the boat and they come swimming to us in a pack, basically, and they play, and they'll even nip and tug at your suit because they're like children teething, you know, what does this feel like? What is this? Like they sort of taste everything to experience it. They'll even pick up little shells or rocks and throw them, or they'll grab our bubbles. They'll capture our bubbles, swim around, and come back to us and spit our own bubbles back in our face.
Oh, how fun.
Yeah,
Oh,
insane.
they've got a little streak in them. We're talking with Jill Heinerth. She is a cave diver, underwater explorer, photographer, filmmaker, and she recently wrote a memoir. It's called Into the Planet. What questions do you have about her work in cave diving? What questions do you have about scuba gear or what your next adventure will be? Join in at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas at WPR.org. Jill, how do you navigate inside a cave that is unknown compared to a cave that has been explored before, that has a roadmap for you?
Yeah, basically, when we explore a cave for the first time, we take a reel of nylon guideline, and we're actually running this safety line through the environment, like tying it off on little protrusions from the rock. Very, very carefully, knowing that if we lose the visibility, that we're going to have to use that as a tactile reference to get all the way back out of the cave. And when we explore that cave, we leave the guideline in place. So we don't reel it up when we exit. We leave it there so that the next time we go back to explore further, we can swim down that guideline to the end, tie on a new reel, and go off into unexplored territory. It's a really important skill that we learn and we practice so that we're very proficient with it.
Oh, you're like leaving crumbs.
Yeah, it is a breadcrumb trail. And if we go off into a branching conduit one way or another, again, we tie off the reel. So there's always a continuous guideline all the way to open water.
What happens with silt and when you're, you know, bringing up so much stuff as you move around? How can you see?
Well, I mean, caves are obviously completely dark, so we have to carry all of our lights with us. We carry at least 3 lights for redundancy. And as we travel through the environment, even just our motion through the water can disturb silt from the walls. Bubbles can strike the ceiling and the silt might rain down on us. And especially in an unexplored cave, you can go into beautifully clear water, but when you turn around to come out, you might not be able to see anything at all. So your lights are of no use, and you're back to putting your hand on the guideline and following it out of the darkness.
Mm. Do your eyes have to adjust once you reach the surface?
Well, as you're getting back towards the entrance of the cave, you start to see a little glimmer of light in the distance, and slowly, you know, it gets brighter and brighter and brighter. Yeah.
Well, here in Wisconsin, there's a limestone cave that feeds into the Wisconsin River. It's called Castle Rock, and exploring.
Yeah.
Oh, you're familiar with it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I haven't dived it, but I know a lot of people who have.
Well,
yeah.
exploring it sometimes requires what's called no mount diving because the cave is so small. What is no mount diving?
So when a cave is really small, like if you can imagine if you had to squeeze underneath like your kitchen chair, right? If you're wearing a lot of equipment, you might not fit. So no mount means taking off all of your breathing apparatus, your tanks and then you push them ahead of you first. You still have like an attachment to it, but you're pushing it ahead of you to get through the hole. And then once you get into larger space, you can put it back on your body. So that's an extreme form of cave diving because you have to be extra careful again about the fact that you may not be able to turn around and your only way to retreat might be moving backwards. So it's definitely for the advanced cave diver with a lot of experience and skills.
We're on a journey with one of the world's best cave divers. Jill Heinerth's new book is called Into the Planet. How do you assess your own tolerance for risk and danger? Have you pushed yourself to do things that are very uncomfortable? What do you want to know about cave diving? Join in. Still time for you. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment here on the Ideas Network. This hour is about a person testing her physical and psychological limits, exploring places no one has been to before in the name of science and discovery. You have aligned to a world-renowned cave diver here on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Jill Heinerth was one of the first people to search for caves inside an iceberg, the B-15, the largest moving object on Earth. You can join in. What questions do you have about caving? How do you test your own limits? We're at 800-642-1234. Her memoir is called Into the Planet, and she stays with us. Jill, you've been on more than 7,500 dives. How do you not let them blur together? Do you remember all of these dives?
Well, yeah, I mean, I certainly remember the momentous ones. And when I go on an expedition, I keep a pretty detailed journal. And that was incredibly important to have when I wrote my book, to remember those details from, you know, 20 years ago and remember what I felt like as a 30-year-old woman.
Yeah. As you age, is diving different as you age? I mean, we heard earlier from Stephen Sheboygan that, you know, he's retired now from diving at age 73.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly develop more and more wisdom as you dive, and that's critically important that you recognize when it's time to make a dive and when it's time to not make a dive and be aware of your limits and continue to have, vigilance over being prepared for dives. So, yeah, I think I'm actually a little more relaxed, but I'm very, very aware and careful about the risks that I take.
Well, let's look at the ecosystem here. You are looking at really significant changes happening to our Earth's water systems and water policies. What is the We Are Water Project?
Well, my husband, Robert McClellan, and I started something called the We Are Water Project, and it was, really an attempt to bring all of the work that I've done through my lifetime together. And what we're trying to spread is what we call water literacy. So helping people to understand where their drinking water resources come from, how they might be overusing them or contaminating them unintentionally, and how they can preserve them for future generations. So it's an effort to connect people with their water resources and understand their impact on them.
When you're diving in like a coral reef and we see what's happening to our coral reefs with the bleaching, what do you make of those changes when you're down there?
Well, I mean, the changes that I've seen, both in coral reef environments and the ocean itself, as well as the sea ice around the world are terrifying. I mean, water issues are one of the most important issues of the next generation, as well as climate change issues. And, I'm terrified by the changes that I've seen in my, short lifetime in terms of the span of time on planet Earth. And that's another one of those really, really big problems that we have to solve as humanity. I mean, the decisions that we make in the next few years will determine whether we will survive as a species. The Earth's going to be fine, but maybe not humans if we don't deal with some of these big problems with water and climate change.
How do you make sure that you don't leave a footprint behind, a trail behind, when you are on these diving expeditions and some places where it's really popular to dive?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm constantly thinking about that. When I was a little girl, my dad always told me when we went camping that we had to leave the campsite better than the way that we found it. And, that's a pretty good ethic for everybody in life, is how can we leave our planet a little bit better and humanity a little bit better than when we found it. Now, these are big problems, just like me being trapped inside a cave, or, Steve having his issue on that shipwreck with air problems. It can be hard to see what the big solutions are, but we always know what the next best small step is to make towards creating a success. And that's what I would advise everybody to do with these large world issues. Just start leading a more, ecologically better life.
Jill, thank you for joining us.
Thank you. It's been great talking with you.
Jill Heinerth, her new memoir is called Into the Planet, My Life as a Cave Diver. And we have a slideshow, by the way, of her underwater explorations on WPR.org/mornings. According across the U.S., small rural hospitals are closing, arguably where they're needed the most. But some hospitals here in Wisconsin have managed to survive or even thrive. And they've done this by forming partnerships, offering unique services and getting creative about doctor recruitment. Shemaine Mills tells us how hospitals are holding their own.
People live in the country to get away from it all, but that soothing solitude can change suddenly. Emergencies often have ordinary beginnings, and this one did. It was a meal Karen Hageman can't forget because it almost killed her. At home with her husband, a piece of steak got stuck in her throat. She recalls thinking, I may need a tracheotomy so I don't suffocate.
Kimball was maybe a 20-minute drive from the hospital, and I remember choking and thinking, oh my God, he's got to get me to a hospital.
Kimball is a tiny town in northern Wisconsin where you're more likely to hear the rumble of logging trucks than the screech of an ambulance siren. It's so far north, the nearest hospital is across the border in Michigan. These critical access hospitals, as they're called, dot the rural landscape. They provide life-saving care, but many of the hospitals themselves need a little TLC. One-fifth of Wisconsin's 76 rural hospitals are losing money. 6 years ago, Memorial Medical Center in Neillsville couldn't get a bank loan, recalls Chief Administrative Officer Ryan Neville.
2013, we had 4 days cash on hand. We lost $3 million that year.
To shore up its finances, the hospital became part of Marshfield Clinic, a national group which analyzes the healthcare industry has looked at such partnerships. Michael Topchick from the Chartis Center for Rural Health says he's seen the good, bad, and ugly of these business arrangements across the U.S., but generally he said they result in better patient outcomes and a stronger bottom line.
So I think affiliation in general is it's something to seek out. Strategically, and you know, the local community can make a decision strategically about how much control do we want to give up, how much independence do we wish to keep. But of course, that's going to be definitely proportional then to the resources you receive.
Independent hospitals are dwindling in Wisconsin. One still open is in Viroqua, where the steep hills of western Wisconsin offer tremendous views, but the winding roads are treacherous travel for the mix of cars, tractors, and Amish buggies. In 2004, retired dairy farmer Jim Service had both knees replaced at the local hospital. Vernon Memorial Healthcare is known for having good outcomes with joint replacement surgeries, and a doctor there will operate on both knees at once, something many orthopedic surgeons won't do.
All I heard is good about him, and I'm like, go see this guy. A couple of my neighbors got their knees replaced, and they said, hey, he's good. So I wasn't going to question that. And all three of us had double knees done.
Specializing in lucrative joint replacement or cardiac care is one way small rural hospitals are trying to attract more patients. Hospitals are also trying to find an untapped segment of the healthcare market. Toma is a central Wisconsin community of 9,000, but attracts patients from further out because the hospital delivers babies underwater in a giant tub at the hospital. But in order to attract more patients, you need doctors to treat them. And it's easier to recruit in urban areas than out in the country, says Tim Size, executive director of the Rural Wisconsin Health Cooperative.
I know hospitals that have trouble recruiting people. They've actually got someone to say, I want to come work with you. And then when they look at what housing's available and what child care is available, they say they just simply can't make it work.
Some rural Wisconsin hospitals, like the one in Neillsville, have brought in doctors from other countries under a special visa program. In addition, the state's two medical colleges have been training future doctors in rural areas in the hopes they'll put down roots. What's at stake isn't just a hospital for patients. It's also jobs for community members. Remember Karen Hageman, who nearly died choking on a piece of meat? She worked at the local hospital. People would miss it, she said, if it were gone. Shemaine Mills, Wisconsin Public Radio.
And this report is part of a collaboration of a dozen newsrooms led by Iowa Watch and the Institute for Nonprofit News, with additional support from the Solutions Journalism Network. For more stories, visit hospitals.iowawatch.org. You're with us on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the Ideas Network.